What's that sound? Oh my God!
Every spring is a spring.
In the house.
Far, far to the north. That sounds so familiar. Far, far to the north of the northernmost boundary of the United States of America lies a particularly foreign country, an uber-exotic nation-state known variously as
Up There
and
Way Up There
and
Canada.
Venture even farther north, and one day you'll come to a city called
Montreal,
which is Canadian for
Montreal.
Or,
I can't get much more north than this.
In the city's northern sector lies an institution of higher learning, known variously as
the northernmost place to learn,
and
damn, it's north up here,
and
Concordia University. Is there any reason why you didn't do some of these in French?
That's not French?
Oh.
Concordia?
I don't think so.
Oh,
sounds right. Latin to me.
Is there a difference between French and Latin? They're both romantic languages, aren't
they? They don't have any letters in common.
Column. Speaking of column, too.
Except maybe the N.
There. Concordia is renowned for its eponymous grape, which grows nowhere else on Earth, save for a few thousand vineyards in the Pacific Northwest and New England. Are we recording?
We are. Oh. I'm just checking. The numbers are rolling.
Excellent.
They're ogival.
But did you know that the ogival shape of its campus?
What campus?
As
Concordia University.
The grape.
Who?
What?
Did I know what about the ogival shape of its campus?
As seen
that it
from
sounds
space,
like the national anthem. Ogival
was once.
Ogival.
was once deemed ideal for supersonic aircraft. In the late 1960s. The school's outline was carefully traced by a French Anglo consortium. The result was a delta-winged Concordia, which really did look like a large grape when airborne.
A large grape shape.
Immediately, the French Xenophobe Bureau complained that the name didn't...
The FXB, or is it the Bureau Xenophobique Français?
Francis. Complained that the name didn't contain enough E's to reflect France's influence on the aircraft's French windows. So the spelling was changed to Concorde.
Oh, Concorde. We like that.
We can visit these pleasant Concordian attractions another time, because we are very near our goal now and must press onward. And on we go. Due north, of course. To the northernmost edge of the campus. But wait. What's this?
What's that? It's gone.
It's gone.
Oh, no.
There used to be a small, nondescript office building here, the northern wing of which held our objective. Instead, there is only a wooden post jammed into the ground.
Into the frozen ground.
Alone.
The solitary frozen ground.
Alone dreadlock hangs from it, waving ambiguously in the breeze.
Oh, I thought it said ambiguously. It's waving ambiguous. And it would be ambiguous.
It would be.
Have a dreadlock. In a post.
One dreaded lock.
Dreaded lock.
Beyond the post lies the beginning of south, so it will be counterproductive to continue in that direction. That leaves east or west. On a hunch, I head east, taking you, our audience, with me. No matter we remain as far north as we can go, the land begins to acquire a distinct eastness.
You can smell it.
At first, I can't put my finger on any one attribute, and then, abruptly, I can. In fact, my whole hand is covered in attributes. Big ones, little ones, sly ones, wet ones, and all of them easterly in their orientation. The color of the ground is easty, and the sky has a definite non-west sheen to it, suggesting that we have already reached the outskirts of the Near East. Off in the distance, I can make out what surely is the Middle East. And beyond that, far beyond, must lie the Far East. Now, this is all fascinating.
Or maybe the Middle Far East.
The Mid?
Or the Far Middle East.
But not the Midwest.
But definitely not. It's Easty, as
Easty,
you said.
Yes. Now, this is all fascinating in a longitudinally peregrinating sort of way. However, we are no closer to our goal than we were 225 words ago. Or 238, if you count this wholly gratuitous sentence.
What was our goal?
We're coming to that.
I see. All right.
No matter, I've invested much in this journey. Already I'm up to 28 sentences, some of which are borderline bewildering. I realize that you, the listening audience, is probably more interested in the denouement.
Now, the problem is the listening audience has gone from plural to singular.
Yes,
since,
I figured the previous... that the listening audience, we've lost some.
Has dwindled from our maximum of two.
How you get there, that is, to the denouement, doesn't matter. So I've decided to dispense with the rest of the trek, including the spine-tingling melee at the junction of East and West, although I invite you to accompany me on that adventure another time, and just go straight to our goal.
Yes.
And suddenly, here we are.
We are where?
Near Austin.
Ah!
Not the southeast Minnesota burg that houses the Spam Museum, and not the city in Texas where you'll find the world's largest badger orchestra. Rather, our goal has been Kevin Austin.
What?
An acousto-electrician who has been at Concordia...
Le Concorde?
The school, not the grape.
Ah.
For nearly 40 years. We're standing in front of his...
This is really a denouement. This is actually a down-a-newmont.
A down...
So far.
I think I can get downer.
Okay, let's go for it. I'm digging.
We're standing in front of his small, nondescript office. The door is closed. Locked. I press the doorbell once... Doorbell.
Yes.
I press the doorbell once, twice, three times, four times, but there is no response. I shinny up the wall and try to peer through the transom, but a nest of badgers up there rehearsing Stravinsky's long-suppressed Song of Palms impedes my view. What happened to the Song of Palms?
I can't do a E minor chord heavy on the third
in
one voice. Maybe I'll do it later.
Yes.
Ready? Here it is. There.
Very well done. If I had employed my writer's prerogative more wisely, I would have made the door ajar and ensured that Austin was inside. I suppose we could wait around, see if he shows up, or even go back to that brouhaha where East meets West that I mentioned. Which really was pretty darn exciting.
So far.
But I sense a growing impatience from our audience.
It's gone up to two again.
Yes.
What, did they come back from the refrigerator?
Maybe one can only surmise.
Or from the dreadlock post where they've been keeping their frozen goods, their ice cream.
There's no frozen goods. There was no mention of frozen goods in here.
It was north.
Close enough.
Up there, way up there.
There is, luckily, another way to Austin.
Ah.
And that's through a door that leads elsewhere. Into the Calvo's
ampersand
Damien house. And here's that door now. I'll just open it for a moment. And... Ah, he is here. He being that Austin chap. Along with Calvo's and Damien and their calming south of the border accents all together.
In the house.
Before we jump right in with the interview, that was Kevin Austin's Three Zheng Etudes, version 2 from 2003.
Oh, like elk?
Elk?
Elk!
Hello?
Hello.
Are you...
You're speaking Canadian. He's speaking Canadian.
He does
again.
That.
No, I don't speak Canadian.
Oh, yeah? Well, let's bring you a little bit back.
So you can't hear my English accent.
No.
Is that what that is?
No, it's...
Yeah, I was born in London.
London, oh, that's near Detroit. Oh.
No, London. London, that's near Hastings. London
is
near
not be hasty.
Hastings.
London,
yes.
Is that? Is
oh,
that
it's near...
It's
Oxford.
An island somewhere.
Yes, it's an island. It's near Reading.
It's...
Reading?
Near Reading. It's a town outside Reading.
East of Uxbridge, as I recall.
Yes.
And that's your carefully cultivated accent just now when you said Reading?
Reading. That's Reading. Because it's called a North London lazy tongue. Because is not the retroflex R, but it goes down below my front teeth in the bottom. It's a recognized dialect of
it is.
Yeah, it's not. It actually is RP. It is the in received pronunciation where the R is actually formed, and the other R is called the retroflex R, which is what is used by most other people.
In Blan.
Why? Oh, Blan. Yeah, Blan.
Life of Blan.
Yes. You can find that. It's on the web. You know, everything's on the web.
Now?
I don't need that.
Yeah. I remember we had a big argument. That I used to be part of a news group called Alt Usage English, and that was always big arguments about that.
About which?
RP.
RP? Mm-hmm. Well, because RP is basically a North London dialect. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
We saw signs as we came in, RP.
No, that's along the RCMP. Is
that too?
URP.
We are what?
URP.
I am?
No,
who
UP.
I did.
UP
earlier.
Up.
No, that was down the hall.
UP up.
Who? He's.
I have no idea.
He's UP mentioning up. Something about our urinary tract.
No, that's Ulysses. That's the pun. The running pun in Ulysses.
Ulysses, that's west of Uxbridge.
That's across the pond, little bit of water, yes. But he was in Geneva when he wrote it. He didn't.
Ulysses Grant was actually.
Yes.
No, the Iliad.
Oh! He was
because they
the
think
muses.
That the
they muses came. They went to England and brought and
no
brought
to
gargoyles.
Ireland. They talked to Ireland. They went. They took it to Ireland. The belief that the first Irish were actually the Greeks.
And it is St. Patrick's Day, so we're very happy to invite you here to Calvus and Damien.
Ah, on the road.
Yes, I knew we'd get
oh,
that.
Oh, is that what we're doing?
Yes.
We're waiting for lunch.
We're waiting for lunch.
So we are. Our guest today is Kevin Austin, who has been one of the people in my life online. It's the first time we've met face-to-face, who has never answered a question.
Oh, well, that's... He will be
I've
doing
I've answered questions all the time.
With other questions?
No. Not me. You're thinking of somebody else, aren't
no,
you?
No, not at all.
Aren't you?
Tell us about yourself, how you got into, particularly, of course, electroacoustics, and how why you're here, and we've...
Tell us about your motor car, because we are interested in the ostinato.
I see. You want me to go on about it?
Yes.
Today is St. Patrick's Day, 2009, right?
Well, not online, it isn't.
No, but I mean, we're talking about what the actual date is.
So is there an actual date?
Yes.
He answered the question. He said
we
yes.
We've
achieved the
we
impossible.
We also give the temperature, and it's about 4 degrees outside. It's about 1:15 in the afternoon.
4 degrees in some
that's
scale.
Kelvin,
Celsius.
I think.
Yes.
Kelvin. Four degrees Kelvin. It's going to 10 today, which is... 50 for those south of the border.
Yes,
see if
that's right.
The war had
50 what? 50 Klingon.
If the war of 1812 had turned out differently, you would understand 10. But the war of 1812 didn't turn out differently, did it?
I don't know.
Terribly
How
sorry.
It turned out the way it turned out. Isn't that history?
No, that's
you're not. He's revising again.
History is an illusion created by the passage of time.
Yes, that's true.
And time is.
Money.
An illusion created by the past. No, money.
Passage of money.
Time isn't money. What is money?
Something that you just passed off to your subservient fellow to fetch you a bun.
Yes.
This isn't going to be very serious.
What?
Discussion.
Well, it's supposed to be a serious discussion, but
we're just
but with all of
the
these, you know, introspective R's that are happening.
The
Ars Nova.
Yes. And the Ars Antiqua.
So you do something here. I mean, you're here at this Concordia place, and you somehow you got here. And so tell us the history of your life encapsulated in 4 minutes.
Well, I began teaching here in 1970 when I was 22. Became full-time 1980.
Does that mean tenure, or do you have tenure?
That was 10 years.
Tenure was 1986. And when I began, I was hired because I could do something called electronic music.
And how did that happen?
Because at McGill at the time there was a studio, and in my fifth year of undergraduate work, I'm a slow learner. Slow learner is a very particular learning disorder, a learning condition. It takes me a long time to learn, so it took me 5 years to do my undergraduate degree. In my fifth year, I substituted. Instead of 20th Century Harmony, I went into the studio. I was in there the first week for 3 hours, and the second week I was there for 25 hours. So I was fish to water. But I'd always been kind of...
What was in that studio at the time?
McGill
Just
studio?
A little bit of what was in there, because this is relatively famous.
Well, there are pictures of the studio, but not of the studio as it was set up. It had a Hewlett-Cain's multi-track playback tape machine in there. It had Hewlett-Cain's spectrogram and his bank of sine tone oscillators. In terms of tape recorders, it had an Ampex A440B 4-channel with a 1/2-inch head block and an Ampex 350. And in the back was an old Ampex 300 that Hewlett-Cain had modified in the mid-50s. And he had adapted it so that it could play at 15 16ths of an inch per second. So this machine had from 15 16ths of an inch to 30 IPS. And it was quite ridiculous, but Hewlett Kane was quite a ridiculous individual in terms of his invention, his idea of how he was going to do sound and what he was going to provide musicians with. He always felt he was creating instruments, not machines.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why the sackbut, as you see, the original sackbut, which was the original voltage-controlled synthesizer, is an instrument. It's not the Moog keyboard with the little modules stuck on top. It's actually an instrument that you play, and the keyboard could be moved from side to side and was pressure sensitive. So you could play, you could hold a note down and push further and it would get louder, and you could do a vibrato and the oscillator would vibrate. And he had a four, he had a quad pan on the corner, pan between the four wave shapes. So you could get vocal qualities and you could get singing kind of qualities from it in the keyboard machine.
And that's what sucked you into the electronic music world.
No, actually, I was in the electronic music world well before that. In the early 60s, I had when we moved to Canada, my parents took one thing. They wanted to be able to exchange, send tapes home.
Ah.
So they bought, before we had a car and before we had a television, we had a tape recorder. And I would play with that tape recorder and do strange little things. That was Sony with little microphone and speaker built into it. And but before
was
that,
those little 3-inch reels.
Yeah, but it would take 7-inch reels.
It would take 7-inch reels.
Yeah,
okay, yeah.
But before that, I think you have to go back to an earlier part in my youth. The role that Christianity has played in my life here. When I was 5 and 6 in school, on Friday afternoons there was a school assembly at which prayers were said, but instead of school assembly, there was the option of taking recorder lessons, and since I didn't want to have to say prayers, I took the recorder lessons, and so I attribute much of my musical development, or sonic development, to Christianity, and I'm very thankful for having avoided those the school assemblies.
Which
however,
is why you're wearing a cassock today.
That's right. But before that, I was in nursery school from the age of 3 months, as happened after the war. And I was the kid that when they brought in at the age of 3 months, in the afternoon they would play beside of a 78 to get the kids to sleep. And everything was fine. They'd play one side of Swan Lake for 5 minutes, and then they would, or the nurse would sit down and have their tea. And then things changed. They brought me in, and one day, the first day I arrived, they put the music on, and they all went to have their tea. 5 minutes later, one kid began screaming. And all the other kids began screaming too. They came back in, they flipped the thank you very much. They flipped the disc.
Thank you, Igor.
Everyone kept quiet. They went out for their tea.
He didn't give you change.
He will. I collect when people die.
I see.
They're called karma points. I have people around here who owe me $14 billion. I bought them a cup of coffee 19 years ago, never told them that I actually wasn't buying it for them, I was just lending them the money.
I see.
So when they die, I get all their good points. So this kid, at the age of 3 months, screamed when the music stopped. And so that was me. And in grade 7, another anecdote, we did the Seashore musical test. I don't know if you ever know.
The what?
Seashore musical test. It was basically a test that checks for memory, pitch memory, and comparison, and degree of intonation capacity and stuff. And we just used it to in schools just to see which kids had reasonably good ears. And I got 139 out of 140 on that test.
Ouch.
So they knew, even though I was only 4'7" and very shy, extremely shy. This is a completely different me now. Very shy. I had shown up on this. And I've been recognized before as having a particularly good ear. And I got to high school, and while I was 4'10 or 4'9, the high school teacher had me play the tuba. And he said...
It's logical.
It's logical, and I had to hold it sideways to play. And I asked him 4 years later, I don't understand why you gave me the tuba. And he said, well, you were too small to play the trombone, because I couldn't reach. And without a bass, you can't tune a band. And he knew I would always be in tune, because my ear was so good. So I played tuba. Well, I never succeeded very well. But I played in Bavarian bands. I have Lederhosen and Hosenträger and the little green hat with the feather like this. I have that all at home. And I put myself through university playing in Bavarian and then eventually in Dixieland bands. and continue with an interest in electronics and technology and kind of things like that.
We're going to jump in with a quick break here to listen to how early can it be, an early piece of Kevin Austin. This is King Bob's Fantasy Variations from 1970, or at least part of it. It's about 20 minutes long, and we'll do just what Kevin wouldn't want, and that's chop it into some pieces. Here it is, King Bob's Fantasy Variations in part.
Thank you. Thank you. Bye.
Well, that was actually all of King Bob's fantasy variation, so let's get back to the quiet discussion up in Montreal with our guest Kevin Austin.
And
this is all so linear. We figured you would have some massive break between early studies and later studies, but there seems to be a continuity here that's entirely...
I'm an earth vet.
Oh, is that it?
Yeah.
So what?
An earth vet.
Oh.
It means he studied animal husbandry.
No, it means I was born in 1948.
Oh.
And the year of the rat is the first year of the Chinese animal cycle of years. And it's always a disruptive year. If you look at the major Republican...
That's why we're talking about St. Patrick today.
The major Republican figures. The major Democratic figures in the States, you'll find that the Hillary Clinton bunch are all... They're all rats. It's all just... But the Chinese have known this for years. So I have a kind of linear mind. I'm very linear. And I'm a very simple person. It helps to be very simple in this life. And simple means that when there's something that appears to be complex, if it continues to appear to be complex, there's something wrong with it. If it can't be reduced down to something really simple, then there's something wrong, fundamentally wrong with it. And so I spent a long time basically working the idea of working to reduction. Like, have you read Ulysses by James Joyce?
Not entirely.
Not recently either.
Oh, I've only read it twice, but there's a very, very fine recording available from Radio Television, which is just a tremendous. It's worth getting the MP3s and just to listen to it. And Ulysses, people have tried to, it's like Marcel Proust, à la recherche de trompe perdu, people, the Monty Python skit about can you reduce and I've reduced this one, 250,000 words to one sentence. It took a while. It's in book 7 of In Search of Lost Time. The Proust Marcel trips in the gutter and his foot falls in the gutter, and he decides that what he will do with his life is he will write a book depicting everything he thought of up until the time he tripped in the gutter. So my summary is Marcel trips in the gutter and writes a book, and that's exactly what it's. And Ulysses is a life in the day, because Ulysses occurs over 24 hours. It's a vertical sectioning of life, and so that's based on the Beatles' Day in Life, but the life in the day. So I like the idea of simplifying things, of coming up with these kind of little things. And you were asking about linearity.
He was.
But I won't if you don't want me to.
You can ask about linearity. I'm a very linear person.
Okay.
I just happen to have 10 or 12, 15 lines occurring simultaneously. It's like polyphony. Polyphony is very linear. It just happens to be that there may be 16 lines going simultaneously.
So linearly speaking, why is there, according to your biography, a 16-year gap between 1987 and 2003 when there were no compositions?
Oh, you gave me 4 minutes to talk about this.
Yes, right then.
Oh, no, you mean there were no public compositions.
Oh, that's correct. So you were just recording everything.
In 87, 88, I took 2-year sabbatical. I had to decide either I was going to teach, be an educator, or I was going to try and get involved in composition. And since my composition wasn't moving and the field was like that, I decided I would devote some time to teaching. And so for 2 years I worked on, I did animation during that time and graphics and other stuff, and began to recapture what I was looking at. When I came back from sabbatical, I was in Poland for 13 weeks on leave. And then shortly after that, I was trained to become chair of the Department of Music, which at that time was a real mess. So
that
I spent...
was that here?
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah. So I spent 3 years getting the department in order. And the big problem in the department was that the theory ear training area was just for the shits, basically. So I said, I will look after this. And so I began teaching the introductory theory and ear training course. And then I wrote a 2-year university level ear training program, which has 45 CDs and 1,000 pages of exercises and sight singing and stuff. And it's possible to take this package and do this, and you can do a full university level 2-year ear training program.
Can you demonstrate this? Our listeners are just fascinated by ear training.
Well, it's the idea, you see, the tie is, it's sight singing, right? You're
yes.
singing the tunes, or you're listening to something, you write it down. It was tied in with the idea of what notation was going to be for electroacoustics. Because with traditional music, Western music, you can say, well, this is the rhythm. I'm going to tap a little, clap a little rhythm for you. You'll tell me what the tune is, right?
Yes.
What is it?
It was just,
yes, it was
coincidentally, just
just 2 days ago.
What was it?
My birthday.
Da 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 da.
Okay.
Da 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 da. What's it with birthdays?
Oh well, wait
also
now.
Happy birthday.
That's right.
To
and now,
you.
How long have you known those two tunes? And
since about yesterday.
And when was the first time you realized they had the same rhythm?
Never thought about it.
Never thought about it. Mm-hmm. So I kind of said, well, that means something happens in the mind that does segmentation and. Some things are segmented and some things are kept together and some things are compared and some things aren't compared. And so my ear training approach is to challenge the student to do some of these comparisons, but to always do it through creativity so that the sight singing exercises would, they would sing 8 tunes and then they'd have to write one of their own. And they'd sing another 8 tunes, they'd have to write another one of their own. They'd sing another 8, they'd have to write another one of their own. And they were integrated with theory. They were tonal and moving towards atonal and all kinds of different systems. And through this, I came in contact, in detailed contact with, quote, normal hearing. Because my hearing had been so, so far off the scale, I'd never understood what, quote, normal hearing was about. It was just so far away. Stuff was so simple for me in hearing. Other stuff was extremely difficult. But it was so simple for me. So I spent the time doing that. And then after about 9 years of that, I went back into EA. I'd also kind of burned out by 1990 in teaching EA. I'd done it for 20 years. And I was telling the same jokes and not knowing whether I told them in the class. And that's a sign of burnout. It's I couldn't remember what it was.
Oh, either that or it's a sign of age. I have the same problem now. I tell you the story I told you yesterday. So,
but then I don't remember it, so it
doesn't matter.
Excellent, excellent,
excellent. You should probably drink your tea before it gets.
So in 1997, there was a student in my class. She plays a guzheng, which is the 21 string Chinese zither, and she said to me, "I want to have you involve electroacoustics in with my instrument." I said, "Oh yes, yes, yes." And in 1998, she was in the class, and she said, "I want to do electroacoustics in the guzheng." I said, "Oh, yes, yes, yes." And then she graduated in 1999 with that. And in 2002, she contacted me, and she said, "My concert is at the end of March. Where are my pieces?"
Well done.
Well
There's
done.
Pressure.
And I'd slowly been trying to teach myself Mandarin for 5 years by that time. Something everyone should try and do after they've read Ulysses and Finnegan's Wake.
Now, just a side question. Does your ear help you with the language?
Or
are they separated enough, you know, the two areas separated enough that doesn't?
Does it help me? No, I have a dreadful ear for languages. Mind you, if you gave me Polish, I could read you the Polish out loud because Polish is a completely phonetic language. Although I wouldn't understand anything I said, I could read it out loud because I learned it phonetically.
That's much like whatever you're saying. I'm not understanding anything at all now, but that doesn't bother me.
Wo bu ming bai.
Ye kui.
Which means, wo bu ming bai means, I don't understand.
Ah, kui.
Wo bu ju dao means, I don't know. Kui is what language?
Beats me.
Birch.
Birch, birch.
Birch.
Yes.
Birch. I see. Oh, that was a province of Burgenstan, right? Isn't that one of those little former Soviet republics down near the Caspian Ocean?
It's actually from New Brunswickistan, but the one in New Jersey, not the one in Canada.
Oh, New Brunswickistan, oh yes. I drove through there. I stopped at Tim Hortons and bought a donut there. New Jersey. That was the brand New Jersey, right?
That was what?
The brand New Jersey?
No, that was the old Jersey.
Oh,
yes.
What did Ella wear? She wore the old jersey or the new jersey?
She wore a brand new...
New jersey.
That's right.
Wait, I'll ask her.
Do that. How are you?
I can't stand this.
No.
It's the problem of having heard those songs in the 60s. like
speaking
that.
Of song, shall we hear something of this fellow's?
Oh, can I was thinking we could just drop things in when he, you know, in pauses that he doesn't take.
Excellent.
But actually, I do have a suggestion to put in as the first piece. It's not my
please.
Piece. It's Daniel Feist, Oxford Nightbird, which you'll hear this afternoon in the concert. Daniel was a neighbor of mine. I can't say student because my students were never students after they decided they were going to become educated because they're no longer students. Mm-hmm. They're now fellow travelers in the path of learning things. And Daniel wrote a piece called Oxford Nightbird, which is 1 minute long.
What's the name of it?
Oxford Nightbird.
It's near Uxbridge.
Near Uxbridge, yes, okay.
And in that piece, you heard the bird, only 1 minute, and the key to Daniel and to much of what things were like at that time was when the speaker says, "No one now listen, no one now listen, no one's listening," is what he wrote down. Because the idea that this bird would sing and no one was listening was very characteristic of how electroacoustic composers would tend to feel in the 70s and 80s. We would do concerts.
But not the 90s?
No, by the 90s, the language had become ingrained in the population because science fiction sound effects were no longer heard as sound effects, they were heard as sound design. And so the sounds that I had made in the 70s, which were ugly and weird and very strange, and the deans would go, ugh. By the 80s, students were starting to come in with some of these sounds in their ears, and by the 90s, they'd grown up with them. And therefore, while I carried the machete through the forest in the 70s, cutting down behind the pioneers such as Hugh Le Cain and Ish Van Aanholt, who had pushed, and Yusashevsky had pushed, started to find the path. I was going through with a machete, widening the path, and I followed them up to the top of the hill, and I turned around to see if anyone was following me, and I found that they were repaving the strip. I had been facing forward for 20 years. I had not noticed that behind me they built a mall and the strip, and all the fast food joints were there, and they were all
and they were just flanking around you now. And we're going to. Yes.
And they were, and I was. I looked over the top of the hill, and I saw them. In fact, they had paved the forest over there, too. So I was kind of left alone up on the hill.
Is that how you got to 2003 and your piece?
Well, what happened in 2003 was Juling kind of insisted on this, and then it brought together
so
a number of.
So you did do
interests.
It. You
I did, yeah, yeah, I did three pieces, which you'll find, actually, you can find them
on
we
Sonus.
We did find it, I just didn't know if those are the pieces that you
were three pieces. They're called Temple. They're the three. And they're very traditional, because if you remember in the 80s, there was the artist whose attitude towards audience was, "I don't care about audience! No, they will interfere with my creativity."
And the 70s and the 60s. I remember those.
And this was these pieces were to be done for an audience of traditional Chinese people within a traditional Chinese concert. And therefore, the sounds had to be completely obnoxious to nobody. Because if they annoyed people, people would get upset and it wouldn't interfere with what it was. So I was very concerned about making sure that the EA components were integrated in a way that was low key. And then I eventually extracted the cues, of which there are so many, and put them into what are called the Zhong Etudes, of which there are two or three versions. And they're the sounds of the Guzheng, processed and cut together and mixed, but not treated in ways to sound electronic or electroacoustic in that language form. The next piece that
if I can just interrupt if they're not treated in order to what word did you use? Give that appearance.
Obnoxious.
No, I know that. Is there a reason why they were done that way? Could they not have been done acoustically? Or are you saying that the sound was accommodating enough that the audiences would not be pushed away by an electronicness of it?
So this is the situation. I had an opportunity to write pieces that would involve electroacoustics that were going to be inside an entirely very traditional Chinese concert with Guzheng and Erhu playing traditional Chinese pieces. And there was going to be 20 minutes, which is very long for this, and I had to... The three pieces are traditional pieces for Gujang, the traditional arrangements of traditional pieces, so everyone in the audience would have known these pieces, and I wanted to present an environment, a sonic environment, that wouldn't disrupt their listening in it from who they were. If this were to be done at a new, well, the ICMC would never accept this because these are tunes, they're pitch-based, they're blah, 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 and it's just in the back. And this was became a concern of mine because I no longer had to be concerned about being isolated and remote from people in the work I did, because I could do that on my own at home in my studio, and I could also do things that would have a public face. And this fit me very well, having always had a public face and an entirely different interior persona of a reclusive individual who I do what I want to do in that way, highly, highly internally motivated, as you can see from my hand. If you look at my hand, you see what you have.
The lifeline is...
We are
three.
Looking at Kevin Austin's hand, our guest today.
So the lifeline, the headline?
Yes.
Yeah, separate till I'm 25. My personality didn't begin to evolve until I was 25 years of age.
But that's metric.
Yes.
So that was actually 80, year 80.
Yeah. And so what you deal with here is an extremely high degree of internal motivation, which is why when people criticize me, I go, oh. Or when the comments, I sometimes just also go, oh.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of rising
the
internal structure, took 25 years to build, and the internal structure is one that goes, yeah, that's possible.
Defensive posturing.
Oh, such bullshit. Where does he get these words from?
I read it.
We have particular vocabularies we use on Cavalos and Damien.
Yes, I know. The bingo card syndrome. You have to use. You have.
Yes.
You didn't think we knew this. We
didn't think it was.
Please don't tell our audience.
No,
please,
we won't tell anybody.
No. We'll break down.
Jeff pointed out to me that he, when in transcribing what you said, he realized that you basically really only had 100 key phrases. And before each show, you would set them in a bowl and you would pull one out and you would say, well, today we have to use the word obnoxious.
Yeah.
And
that has happened more often than you would think.
Where do you hear the essay that comes out of this one?
Which has naturally been written already.
I bet it has.
Oh, yes.
Well, do you believe in time?
Time whom?
Yes. Warner. But time is just an illusion created by the passage of history, of course. That's from The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
Oh, is it?
Yes.
I don't remember that. Where was that?
In the first one.
In the first one?
It's about time and history. It says time is an illusion created by the passage of history. And when you read the guide, it will tell you what history is.
Yes.
History is an illusion created by the passage of time. So we're all 42 in a, you know.
In a real sense.
In the real
sense. Real sense.
of what that is. So... I've had multiple, many different divergent kind of things I've done over the years, and one way of becoming older is to not die young.
How very
very linear.
I'm sorry. I'm sorry.
And so here you are.
And so here
How
I am.
How that happened. That was the premise you used in order to get here.
To get here, I just figured if I lived long enough, I would become old.
We're going
to
take a sandwich break.
Please.
And then we'll be back.
Okay.
Our guest is Kevin Austin here on Calvos and Damien.
In the house. On the road.
While we're taking our lunch break, we'll listen to Kevin's Static Gestures 2, Formant Pulses from 1987. Our guest, Kevin Austin, here's some... stuff to pulse with for lunch.